previous government, joined by the Kurds, who formed 25% of the population.
Absolutely. The real issue, though, once the government is formed, is what they're going to do with the Constitution, because the Constitution they passed is extremely flawed. A lot of basic issues were swept under the rug that are going to have to be dealt with.
Well, President Bush has now emerged onto the dais at the Woodrow Wilson Center, accepting applause from the audience there. Scholars, staff from the Woodrow Wilson Center, members of the Board of Trustees of that organization, members of the Wilson Council and the Wilson Alliance, and now he's being introduced by the Chairman of the Board of Trustees, Joseph Gildenhorn.
And welcome to the Ronald Reagan Building and the Wilson Center. Here at the Woodrow Wilson Center, it is our founding mission to serve as a living memorial to a great American president, Woodrow Wilson. President Wilson served at a time of great testing, the U.S. entry into World War I. He said, and I quote, "The world must be safe for democracy. Its peace must be planted upon the tested foundations of political liberty." President Bush, too, serves at a time of great testing in our fight against terrorism. He also articulates the bond between America's security and America's ideals. And President Bush also sees it as our country's responsibility to seek a peace in the world on the foundations of political liberty. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to introduce the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Thank you, Joe. Good job. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate you. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Please be seated. Thank you for the warm welcome. I'm delighted to be here with the men and women of the Wilson Center. According to your mission statement, the center was created to bring together two groups, political leaders and scholars. I see some of the political leaders who are here, and I presume you've invited me to uphold the scholars' end. I've come to discuss an issue of vital importance to the American people, and that is victory in the war on terror. September 11, 2001, our nation awoke to a sudden attack, and we accepted new responsibilities. We are confronting new dangers with firm resolve. We're hunting down the terrorists and their supporters. We will fight this war without wavering, and we will prevail. In the war on terror, Iraq is now the central front. And over the last few weeks, I've been discussing our political, economic, and military strategy for victory in that country. An historic election will take place tomorrow in Iraq. And as millions of Iraqis prepare to cast their ballots, I want to talk today about why we went into Iraq, why we stayed in Iraq, and why we cannot and will not leave Iraq until victory is achieved. I want to thank Ambassador Gildenhorn for inviting me and introducing me, and I want to thank the members of the Board of Trustees who are here. I appreciate Lee Hamilton, serves our nation so well in so many different capacities. Thank you for being the President and Director of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm proud to be traveling today with members of my cabinet, Secretary of State Condi Rice, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, and Secretary of Homeland Security Mike Chertoff. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate the members of the Congress who are here. Thanks for taking time to come. I want to thank the members of the Diplomatic Corps that have joined us today, and thank you all for being here as well. We are living through a watershed moment in the story of freedom. Most of the focus now is on this week's elections, and rightly so. Iraqis will go to the polls to choose a government that will be the only constitutional democracy in the Arab world. Yet we need to remember that these elections are also a vital part of a broader strategy for protecting the American people against the threat of terrorism. We saw the future the terrorists intend for our nation on that fateful morning of September the 11th, 2001. That day we learned that vast oceans and friendly neighbors are no longer enough to protect us. September the 11th changed our country. It changed the policy of our government. We adopted a new strategy to protect the American people. We would hunt down the terrorists wherever they hide. We would make no distinction between the terrorists and those who harbor them. And we would advance our security at home by advancing freedom in the Middle East. September the 11th also changed the way I viewed threats like Saddam Hussein. We saw the destruction terrorists could cause with airplanes loaded with jet fuel. And we imagined the destruction they could cause with even more powerful weapons. At the time, the leaders of both political parties recognized this new reality. We cannot allow the world's most dangerous men to get their hands on the world's most dangerous weapons. In an age of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, if we wait for threats to fully materialize, we will have waited too long. We removed Saddam Hussein from power because he was a threat to our security. He had pursued and used weapons of mass destruction. He sponsored terrorists. He ordered his military to shoot at American and British pilots patrolling the no-fly zones. He invaded his neighbors. He fought a war against the United States and a broad coalition. He had declared that the United States of America was his enemy. Over the course of a decade, Saddam Hussein refused to comply with more than a dozen United Nations resolutions, including demands that he respect the rights of the Iraqi people, disclose his weapons, and abide by the terms of a 1991 ceasefire. He deceived international inspectors, and he denied them the unconditional access they needed to do their jobs. When a unanimous Security Council gave him one final chance to disclose and disarm or face serious consequences, he refused to comply with that final opportunity. At any point along the way, Saddam Hussein could have avoided war by complying with the just demands of the international community. The United States did not choose war. The choice was Saddam Hussein's. When we made the decision to go into Iraq, many intelligence agencies around the world judged that Saddam possessed weapons of mass destruction. This judgment was shared by the intelligence agencies of governments who did not support my decision to remove Saddam. And it is true that much of the intelligence turned out to be wrong. As president, I'm responsible for the decision to go into Iraq. And I'm also responsible for fixing what went wrong by reforming our intelligence capabilities. And we're doing just that. At the same time, we must remember that an investigation after the war by Chief Weapons Inspector Charles Dolfer found that Saddam was using the UN Oil for Food program to influence countries and companies in an effort to undermine sanctions with the intent of restarting his weapons programs once the sanctions collapsed and the world looked the other way. Given Saddam's history and the lessons of September the 11th, my decision to remove Saddam Hussein was the right decision. Saddam was a threat, and the American people and the world is better off because he is no longer in power. We are in Iraq today because our goal has always been more than the removal of a brutal dictator. It is to leave a free and democratic Iraq in its place. As I stated in a speech in the lead-up to the war, a liberated Iraq could show the power of freedom to transform the Middle East by bringing hope and progress to the lives of millions. So we're helping the Iraqi people build a lasting democracy that is peaceful and prosperous, and an example for the broader Middle East. The terrorists understand this, and that is why they have now made Iraq the central front in the war on terror. The enemy of freedom in Iraq is a combination of rejectionists and Saddamists and terrorists. The rejectionists are ordinary Iraqis, mostly Sunni Arabs, who missed the privileged status they had under the regime of Saddam Hussein. We believe that over time, most of this group will be persuaded to support the democratic Iraq, led by a federal government that is strong enough to protect minority rights. We're encouraged by the indications that many Sunnis intend to participate in tomorrow's elections. The Saddamists are former regime loyalists who harbor dreams of returning to power. And they're trying to foment anti-democratic sentiment amongst the larger Sunni community. Yet they lack popular support. And over time, they can be marginalized and defeated by the security forces of a free Iraq. The terrorists affiliated with or inspired by al-Qaeda are the smallest but most lethal group. They are led by a brutal terrorist named Zarqawi. He's al-Qaeda's chief operations officer in Iraq. He has stated his allegiance to Osama bin Laden. The terrorists have ambitions. They have goals. They want to stop the advance of freedom in Iraq. They wanted to make Iraq what Afghanistan was under the Taliban, a safe haven from which they can plot attacks against our people. There is no limit to their brutality. They kill the innocent to achieve their aims. This is an enemy without conscience. And against such enemy, there is only one effective response. We will never back down, we will never give in, and we will never accept anything less than complete victory. Last month, my administration released a document called the National Strategy for Victory in Iraq. In recent weeks, I've been discussing our strategy with the American people. The U.S. Naval Academy, I spoke about how we changed our approach to training Iraqi security forces so they can take the fight to the enemy and eventually take responsibility for the security of their citizens without major foreign assistance. Iraqi forces are becoming more and more capable. This time last year, there was only a handful of Iraqi battalions ready for combat. Now there are more than 125 Iraqi army and police combat battalions in the fight against the terrorists. Of these, more than 70 Iraqi battalions are fighting side by side with coalition forces, and more than 50 others are taking the lead in the fight. So far in December, there have been more than 900 combat operations in Iraq at the company level or above, and 75% of these involved Iraqi security forces either in the lead or fighting side by side with our coalition. As these Iraqi forces grow in size and strength, American and coalition forces can concentrate on training Iraqis and hunting down high-value targets like Zarqawi and his associates. Last week, before the Council on Foreign Relations, I explained how we changed our approach to help Iraqis hold and rebuild cities taken from the enemy, and how to help them revitalize Iraq's infrastructure and economy. Today, many cities like Mosul and Najaf are coming back to life, and Iraq's economy is growing. Thousands of new businesses have opened in Iraq. Personal income is up. And according to one survey, 7 in 10 Iraqis say their lives are going well, and nearly two-thirds expect things to improve in the next year. Earlier this week at the Philadelphia World Affairs Council, I spoke in depth about how we changed our approach to helping the Iraqis build their democracy. At the request of Iraqi leaders, we accelerated the transition to Iraqi self-government. We set 4 major milestones to guide Iraq's transition to constitutional democracy: the transfer of sovereignty, elections for a transitional government, the adoption of a democratic constitution, and elections for a new government under that constitution. In spite of the violence, Iraqis have met every milestone, and this is changing the political landscape in Iraq. Sunni Arabs who failed to participate in the January elections are now campaigning vigorously in this week's elections, and we can expect a higher turnout of Sunni voters. As Sunnis join the political process, Iraqi democracy becomes more inclusive, and the terrorists and Saddamists are becoming marginalized. Each of the changes we have made in our approach in Iraq is helping us meet the hard realities and the facts on the ground. We've adapted our tactics. We have fixed what was not working. And we have listened to those who know best, our military commanders and the Iraqi people. Our tactics continue to change, but our goal in Iraq has not changed: a free and democratic Iraq. I strongly believe a democratic Iraq is a crucial part of our strategy to defeat the terrorists, because only democracy can bring freedom and reconciliation to Iraq and peace to this troubled part of the world. Our efforts to advance freedom in Iraq are driven by our vital interests and our deepest beliefs. America was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and we believe that the people of the Middle East desire freedom as much as we do. History has shown that free nations are peaceful nations. And as Iraqi democracy takes hold, Iraqi citizens will have a stake in a common and peaceful future. As we advance the cause of freedom in Iraq, our nation can proceed with confidence, because we have done this kind of work before. After World War II, President Harry Truman believed that the way to help bring peace and prosperity to Asia was to plant the seeds of freedom and democracy in Japan. Like today, there were many skeptics and pessimists who said that the Japanese were not ready for democracy. Fortunately, President Harry Truman stuck to his guns. He believed, as I do, in freedom's power to transform an adversary into an ally. And because he stayed true to his convictions, today Japan is one of the world's freest and most prosperous nations, and one of America's closest allies in keeping the peace. The spread of freedom to Iraq and the Middle East requires the same confidence and persistence, and it will lead to the same results. The people of Iraq are now seeing some of the tangible benefits of their new democracy. They see that as freedom advances, their lives are improving. Iraqis have approved a bold constitution that guarantees the rule of law and freedom of assembly and property rights and freedom of speech and the press and women's rights and the right to vote. They see their freedom increasingly being defended by their own soldiers and police instead of foreign forces. And they see that freedom is bringing opportunity and a better life. The Iraqis still face many challenges, including security and reconstruction and economic reform. But they're building a strong democracy that can handle these challenges, and that will be a model for the Middle East. Freedom in Iraq will inspire reformers from Damascus to Tehran. This new Iraq shares our deepest values, and it shares our most determined enemies. By helping Iraqis build a nation that can govern itself, sustain itself, and defend itself, we will gain an ally in the war on terror and a partner for peace in the Middle East. Stakes in Iraq are high, and we will not leave until victory has been achieved. Today, there is an intense debate about the importance of Iraq to the war on terror. The constant headlines about car bombings and killings have led some to ask whether our presence in Iraq has made America less secure. This view presumes that if we were not in Iraq, the terrorists would be leaving us alone. The reality is that the terrorists have been targeting America for years, long before we ever set foot in Iraq. We were not in Iraq in 1993 when the terrorists tried to blow up the World Trade Center in New York. We were not in Iraq in 1998 when the terrorists bombed our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. We were not in Iraq in 2000 when the terrorists killed 17 American sailors aboard the USS Cole. There wasn't a single American soldier in Iraq on September the 11th, 2001, when the terrorists murdered nearly 3,000 people in the worst attack on our home since Pearl Harbor. These acts are part of a grand strategy by the terrorists. Their stated objective is to drive the United States and coalition forces out of the Middle East so they can gain control of Iraq and use that country as a base from which to launch attacks against America, overthrow moderate governments in the Middle East, and establish a totalitarian Islamic empire that stretches from Spain to Indonesia. Hear the words of the terrorists. In a letter to the terrorist leader Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda leader Zawahiri has outlined plans that will unfold in several stages. These are his words. Expel the Americans from Iraq. Establish an Islamic authority over as much territory as you can to spread its power in Iraq. Extend the jihad wave to secular countries neighboring Iraq. End quote. To achieve these goals, the terrorists are targeting innocent men, women, and children. The enemy has only the ability to create chaos for the cameras with spectacular acts of violence. They know they cannot defeat us militarily. So they're trying to break our will in the hopes of getting America to leave the battlefield early. And they cite Vietnam as a reason they can prevail. Zawahiri, in his letter to Zarqawi, wrote, "The aftermath of the collapse of the American power in Vietnam and how they ran and left their agents is noteworthy. In the past, al-Qaeda has said that American pullouts of Lebanon and Somalia showed them that America is weak and could be made to run. And now the terrorists think they can make America run in Iraq. There's only one way the terrorists can prevail. If we lose our nerve and leave before the job is done, and that is not going to happen on my watch." Some in Washington are calling for a rapid and complete withdrawal of our forces in Iraq. They say that our presence there is the cause for instability in Iraq, and that the answer is to set a deadline to withdraw. I disagree. I've listened carefully to all the arguments, and there are four reasons why I believe that setting an artificial deadline would be a recipe for disaster. First, setting an artificial deadline would send the wrong message to the Iraqis. As Iraqis are risking their lives for democracy, it would tell them that America is more interested in leaving than helping them succeed. Put at risk all the democratic progress they have made over the past year. Secondly, setting an artificial deadline would send the wrong message to the enemy. It would tell them that if they wait long enough, America will cut and run. It would vindicate the terrorist tactics of beheadings and suicide bombings and mass murder. It would embolden the terrorists and invite new attacks on America. Third, setting an artificial deadline would send the wrong message to the region and the world. Would tell our friends and supporters that America is a weak and unreliable ally, and that when the going gets tough, America will retreat. Finally, setting an artificial deadline would send the wrong message to the most important audience, our troops on the front line. It would tell them that America is abandoning the mission they are risking their lives to achieve, and that the sacrifice of their comrades killed in this struggle has been in vain. I make this pledge to the families of the fallen. We will carry on the fight, we will complete their mission, and we will win. Victory will be achieved by meeting certain objectives. When the terrorists and Saddamists can no longer threaten Iraq's democracy, when the Iraqi security forces can protect their own people, and when Iraq is not a safe haven for terrorists to plot attacks against our country. These objectives, not timetables set by politicians in Washington, will drive our force levels in Iraq. As Iraqis stand up, we will stand down, and when victory is achieved, our troops will then come home with the honor they have earned. One of the blessings of our free society is that we can debate these issues openly, even in a time of war. Most of the debate has been a credit to our democracy. Some have launched irresponsible charges. They say that we act because of oil, that we act in Iraq because of Israel, or because we misled the American people. Some of the most irresponsible comments about manipulating intelligence have come from politicians who saw the same intelligence I saw and then voted to authorize the use of force against Saddam Hussein. These charges are pure politics. They hurt the morale of our troops. Whatever our differences in Washington, our men and women in uniform deserve to know that once our politicians vote to send them into harm's way, our support will be with them in good days and bad, and we will settle for nothing less than complete victory. Before this victory comes, we still have a lot of difficult work ahead. We've made real progress in the last 2.5 years, and the terrorists see this progress, and they're determined to stop it. These enemies are not going to give up because of a successful election. They know that as democracy takes root in Iraq, their hateful ideology will suffer a devastating blow. So we can expect violence to continue. We can also expect that the elections will be followed by days of uncertainty. We may not know for certain who's won. The elections until the early part of January, and that's important for our citizens to understand. It's going to take a while. It's also going to take a while for them to form a government. The work ahead will require patience of the Iraqi people and require our patience as well. Yet we must remember that a free Iraq is in our interests, because a free Iraq will be a beacon of hope. And as the Middle East grows in liberty, the American people will become safer, and our nation will be more secure. The work ahead will also require continued sacrifice. Yet we can be confident, because history has shown the power of freedom to overcome tyranny. And we can be confident because we have on our side the greatest force for freedom in human history, the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. One of these men was a Marine lieutenant named Ryan McLaughlin from Lebanon, Virginia. Ryan was a bright young man who had everything going for him, and he always wanted to serve our nation. He was a valedictorian of his high school class. He graduated from William and Mary with near-perfect grade averages. And he was on a full scholarship at Stanford, where he is working toward a doctorate in chemistry. 2 years after the attacks of September the 11th, the young man who had the world at his feet came home from Stanford for a visit. He told his dad, "I just don't feel like I'm doing something that matters. I want to serve my country. I want to protect our land from terrorists, so I joined the Marines." When his father asked him if there was some other way to serve, Ryan replied that he felt a special obligation to step up because he had been given so much. Ryan didn't support me in the last election, but he supported our mission in Iraq, and he supported his fellow Marines. Ryan was killed last month fighting the terrorists near the Iraq-Syrian border. In his pocket was a poem that Ryan had read at his high school graduation, and it represented the spirit of this fine Marine. The poem was called, "Don't Quit." In our fight to keep America free, we'll never quit. We've lost wonderful Americans like Ryan McLaughlin. We cherish the memory of each one. We pray the loved ones, pray for the loved ones they've left behind, and we count it a privilege to be citizens of a country they served. We also honor them by acknowledging that their sacrifices brought us to this moment, the birth of a free and sovereign Iraqi nation that will be a friend of the United States and a force for good in a troubled region of the world. The story of freedom has just begun in the Middle East. And when the history of these days is written, it will tell how America once again defended its own freedom by using liberty to transform nations from bitter foes to strong allies. And history will say that this generation, like generations before, laid the foundation of peace for generations to come. May God bless you all. Thank you very much.
President Bush speaking at the Woodrow Wilson International Center here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We just heard President Bush speaking at the Woodrow Wilson Center. The speech lasted about 30 minutes, a little bit more than that. And this was the fourth in the series of speeches the president has made over the past couple of weeks, laying out what the White House has been describing as the strategy for victory in Iraq. Joining us here in the studio are NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving and NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins. Also with us is George Packer, author of Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, and Adid Dawisha, Professor of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And Ron, I'm going to start with you. We were led to expect a summary of the president's previous speeches on Iraq, and in large part, that's what we got.
I would say so. I would also say that a great portion of the speech was verbatim from the speech that we heard at the Naval Academy 2 weeks ago, or from the speech he gave in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, on Monday. So the wording had apparently been settled. They were happy with what they were saying, and they decided to stick with it. Perhaps the most affecting part of the speech, and the one part we had not heard anything of before, was the story of Ryan McLaughlin, the Marine from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, who went to William & Mary College of William & Mary and then to Stanford University, gave up his career in academia, and went to war and gave his life earlier this fall. That was a very moving story the president finished with in his speech. But apart from that, there probably was not a paragraph or a sentence that had not been in a previous speech that he's given in this series.
The president said he was going to be speaking today about why we went to Iraq, why we stay, and why we cannot leave without victory, or as he said several other times in his speech, without complete victory. Lauren Jenkins, again, on the security front in terms of Iraq, he was speaking in terms of training Iraqi forces, and the litany we've heard for a much longer time than just the past couple of weeks, as Iraqi forces stand up, American forces can stand down. And again, he pointed to progress in terms of more and more Iraqi forces taking on the security burden in the war against the Saddamists and the terrorists.
Absolutely. I mean, but this is certainly a line we've been hearing all along, that before we can ever consider leaving or withdrawing, the Iraqis have to stand up. The real issue remains is just how good that training has been. There's been a lot of contradictory evidence one way and the other that they've certainly improved over a couple of years, but they're still very far from being able to take on their own security considerations to the point that we're promised that we'd be able to start withdrawing U.S. troops.
Mm-hmm. And that is on the in terms of the Iraqi army forces. Iraqi internal security forces run by the Interior Ministry have been even more problematical.
They've been mostly the Iraqi interior forces are part of the disbanded leading Shia militia has been brought in as security forces, and they've acted atrociously from what one has begun to find from secret prisons where Sunnis were held and tortured. They're very unreliable as a security force right now.
George Packer, let me turn to you. The president sort of recapped a lot of the arguments about going into Iraq in the first place. The U.S., he said, did not choose war. The choice was Saddam Hussein's. Your book addresses a lot about this chapter in history, and this is a semantic argument, but in fact, this has been described as a war of choice by the United States from the very beginning.
Yeah, Richard Haass, the former director of policy planning at the State Department under Colin Powell, has said that it was a war of choice. It was. It was a war that was settled on early in 2002, after which arguments were assembled to justify it. And those arguments came down to weapons of mass destruction. We all know they weren't found. I think the president has a pretty hard job right now in revisiting those arguments from 2002, 2003, in calling on Americans to continue this effort in Iraq. I mean, he's trying to situate Iraq once again in the larger war on terrorism. There was a good deal in his speech about that, which we've heard before. Mm-hmm. But the reality in Iraq is looking more and more like a power struggle between Iraq's main groups. The Shia, who, as Lauren Jenkins was saying, have taken over the interior ministry and have infiltrated the police force and made it more and more an instrument of parties and militias. And the Sunni Arabs, who are now beginning to join the political process, but who may well be using the political process to advance sectarian interests that are also being advanced by the insurgency. It may well be that the Sunni Arabs are going to play a kind of inside-outside game from here on out, much as, for example, the IRA used Sinn Féin as its political face. I don't think that we're going to see marginalization of the insurgents as a result of this election. I think we're going to see a kind of a double strategy, which is not going to reduce the violence in any serious way for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And Adid Dawisha, let me bring you in. There's another speech of the president's that this one was reminiscent of, and that was his inaugural address, his second inaugural, where he laid out this this vision of Iraq as the linchpin to a broader movement of democracy and freedom across the Middle East. And he spoke about that again today, about this is a watershed moment, not just for a constitutional democracy in Iraq, but for movements more broadly throughout the Middle East. Is that promise being redeemed?
Well, he actually did mention specifically Syria and Iran, which was very interesting. These were, of course, the contiguous states to Iraq, but also the ones that have been giving us the most trouble by allowing all the insurgents, either from the Iranian side or from the Syrian side, to go into Iraq. I wasn't very clear whether this was a promise or a threat in the way he put it. However, there is an argument that a successful kind of democratic experiment in Iraq will have some kind of a spillover effect on the other countries in the region. People will have argued that Saudi Arabia's recent moves for the first election for municipals ever, the first direct presidential elections in Egypt, movements in Qatar and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates for more kind of political representation. It is argued that this would not have happened had the freedom, or at least the democratic process, taken some kind of hold in Iraq. It remains to be seen, but certainly you can argue that some kind of spillover effect is being transplanted into the rest of the Arab world.
Ron Elving, let me turn to you again. The president devoted a considerable part of the second half of his speech to addressing his critics here in this country. He talked about the importance of debate and why that is such an important element of democracy. But in arguing why we have to stay, he was saying the goal was more than the removal of a dictator, this seeming to respond to that element of a public opinion in the United States said, well, we went into Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein, get rid of weapons of mass destruction. One is gone. The other wasn't there in the first place. Why are we still there?
There was a theory that was driving much of what the administration did in 2003 and that had been to some degree made plain in the run-up to the war in 2002 and 2003, that Iraq was the linchpin of the Middle East, that Saddam Hussein was not just another dictator, not just another bad actor on the world stage, but a critical force who was making the difference between one good direction for the Middle East and another bad direction. Mm-hmm. And there was also a positive side to this vision. Came from Paul Wolfowitz, who was then the Deputy Secretary of Defense and has since left the administration, is now running the World Bank. Professor Wolfowitz had argued, and he was a man with a strong academic background, that if you could set up a modern democracy, a secular democracy in Iraq, you could make it a beacon to the rest of the Middle East, and that this would become a new model. It would become, if you will, a model in contrast to that of a religious government or a theocracy. And it would be something that we could work with more successfully than the monarchies we worked with in the past, that it would be something like the United States. It would have many of our characteristics of government, much of our civic life, and that this was ultimately a breakthrough for the United States and for, if you will, freedom in the world, democracy in the world, and a great defeat for terrorism. It was a magnificent vision. And what we have seen in the ensuing years is that the insurgency, the resistance in Iraq, the reality on the ground has made it exceedingly difficult to bring that vision to fruition.
Adi Dawisha, in his discussion, the president cited recent opinion polls reported from Iraq that most Iraqis look forward to the next year with optimism. Again, it's going to be that will be tested, we suspect. But the president did not report on overwhelming public support in Iraq for the end of the occupation.
I think that there is consensus that Iraqis do not want the occupation. However, the critical question here is whether Iraqis want the Americans to get out now or whether they want them to get out in time after the state is stable. If you ask any Iraqi whether he wants the Americans to stay there forever, of course they're going to say no. But the division is, and I think that probably the majority of thinking Iraqis at least do appreciate that at the moment, this particular time is not the time for the Americans to leave. But they certainly support the notion that over maybe a year, 2 years, or 3 years, if the Iraqi state is stable enough, if it can take care of its own security, then the Americans can leave all of this in the hand of the Iraqis.
It remains to be seen exactly whether the United States plans to ever withdraw completely. There are reports of bases that are planned to stay.
Can I just say, this morning there was an interview at the Al Jazeera with Zalmay Khalilizad, our ambassador, and he categorically said, he was saying this to the Arab public, that the Americans have no intention of staying, that once the job is done, in the sense that once they see that the Iraqis are capable of taking care of themselves, then he promises, and this is coming from a public figure in his own words, that the Americans will leave, we hope that the Iraqis will remain friendly to America, but America has absolutely no intention of either staying there, having bases there, or in any kind of hegemonic role over the Middle East. This was this morning on Jazeera TV.
And that's a clarification. I wanted George Packer to ask you, the president also, in discussing WMD and American intelligence, he said, of course, the most of that intelligence turned out to be wrong. As the president, I am responsible for that and for trying to fix what had gone wrong there. Is that a new admission?
No, he said that in the past, and then he immediately turned to addressing his Democratic congressional critics and accusing them of making irresponsible charges that were pure politics. So the moment of sort of self-criticism was extremely brief, and it immediately turned to countering attacks made by his opponents. But, you know, it struck me that here he is speaking at the Woodrow Wilson Center. But most of the speech, in as far as it was historical, was about Harry Truman and about the post-World War II effort to democratize Japan. And here we have a president who wants to see himself in that tradition of Harry Truman as a man who made it the work of a generation to bring peace and democracy to former enemies. And the question is going to be, will he be the Harry Truman of this era and of Iraq, or will he be the Woodrow Wilson? Because he didn't talk much about Woodrow Wilson, and one reason may be because Woodrow Wilson's presidency ended with a series of speeches in which Wilson tried to bring the country around to a grand vision of democracy and peace based on the League of Nations, which the American Congress rejected, and Wilson's presidency ended with him paralyzed by a stroke and essentially incapacitated and politically marginalized. And President Bush is flirting with marginalization himself as Congress moves more and more toward a skeptical position toward the war, and as the public does as well. And he's used these speeches to try to reestablish himself as the Harry Truman rather than the Woodrow Wilson of the early 21st century. And we'll see, you know, in 10 or 20 years how he's regarded.
It's interesting. Ron Elving, Harry Truman, of course, regarded as a tough guy who made unpopular decisions and has been vindicated by history, remains to be seen. But he certainly had his critics in Congress. And President Bush today, I think it's, 40 Democrats and an independent, released a letter saying that he needs to establish a clearer plan for victory in Iraq.
Yes, 40 Democrats and one independent, that's James Jeffords from Vermont, signed a letter today, sent to the president today, in which they urged him to be more forthcoming, more frank, to tell Iraqis exactly what is the American plan. Because, you know, we look at this situation, there's a tremendous subjective judgment to be made here. What does complete victory mean? Does it mean that absolutely everything in Iraq must be proceeding as it might be envisioned by the State Department? Does it mean that the Iraqis are standing up in some measure so we can stand down? What are the percentages of troops that might withdraw in the next month or in the next 6 months or the next 12 months? I'm not asking someone to put that out as a timetable necessarily. I'm just saying, who is going to make that judgment? Someone is going to make that judgment. And for the Iraqis to trust that we really do want to get out after order has been established, that we don't want to maintain some kind of hegemony there, that we aren't interested primarily in their oil resources, a question that is still quite a live question in Iraq and among many Americans. If we are going to convince them of that, how do we do it? Who's going to make these judgments? Can we be a little more frank with the Iraqis and with the American people about what our plans really are?
I want to focus the last few minutes that we have. Adid Dawisha, I wanted to begin by asking you about the way ahead. The president warned that it would be some time before we may know who won the elections in Iraq, and it may be a longer time before they can establish a working government in Baghdad. And I think he's probably right on both those grounds. But are the American people and the Iraqi people banking a lot on the success of this first government, the first four-year government set up under Iraq's constitution?
Well, first of all, there is a great excitement in Iraq and amongst Iraqis about the elections. In fact, I myself am very excited. I'm going to be driving 5.5 hours tomorrow to Chicago to vote myself with my children. So there is a great excitement, and I see that in all of the TVs, Arab TV that I watch, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera. The excitement is that the ability for the first time over 50 years to go to the polls and actually vote in a free and fair elections. That's one. Secondly, I think there might be an exaggerated hope that somehow this election is going to solve all problems. I think the president did well by preparing both the Iraqis and the American public that it will take some time for these groups to form some kind of a coalition. In fact, if you look at the configurations this time around, you're not going to have the two parties or two groups dominating the National Assembly in the way that the United Iraqi Alliance, the Shiite group, and the Kurds did last time. This time there's going to be more than two, three or even four of these groups having to get together to form some kind of a coalition. That is, of course, a problem because it will take longer. But it's also not a bad thing that for these groups to start compromising, knowing that the only way they can form a government is by compromising on some basic issues. And we might end up, if one is hopeful, we might end up with a more moderate government for Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And George Packer, this is a sometimes messy business, but this is the business of government in democracy.
That's right. And this is the third time Iraqis will have voted in a year. Some people worry about election fatigue setting in, but because new groups have entered the process with each stage, it gives more and more Iraqis the experience of voting and then of essentially being disappointed in the results. It's a kind of a natural part of representative government to be disappointed in the louts who won elects into office. And at the moment, there's great disappointment with the Jafari government, which was formed after the January elections. And it'll be interesting to see whether Shiite Iraqis, out of that disappointment, withhold their vote from the Shiite list this time around and instead vote for another list, perhaps a more secular and mixed list, because sectarian government has not produced security and has not brought services. And in a way, that is the great thing about representative government. Once people see the conditions of their own lives, their vote is going to be affected accordingly, and more Iraqis are going to have that experience, and that is a good thing.
Lauren Jenkins, the Constitution also provides a window for changing the Constitution once the new parliament has been elected. And you were talking before the president's speech started about one of the most important factors may have to be some sort of a rewrite to the Constitution to resolve some unresolved questions.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot was swept under the rug when they formed the Constitution because they couldn't agree on some very basic issues. And they provided for the ability for the new parliament to come back and revisit the Constitution and see if amendments could be made to make it more workable. The problems of the Constitution are, one, it creates an extremely strong parliament and extremely weak executive, which, given the sectarian differences in Iraq, is going to be a significant problem. The other one is the whole question of federalism and how that can be applied. As written in the Constitution, it would allow the larger Shia community and the 9 provinces of the 18 that they basically dominate to form their own mini-state with very strong near-sovereign powers, much as the Kurds have already carved out almost a quasi-independent state in the north. And this basically, as many critics have said of the Constitution, could lead not to the unity of Iraq, but to its greater division.
And Ron Elving, let me wind up with you and ask, in part, the president's these series of speeches started after Democrat John Murtha, a well-respected, generally pro-military representative from Pennsylvania, made his speech saying it's time, there's no more the U.S. military can accomplish in Iraq, let's get out within a year. Has the president, we mentioned he's had a slight repair, the bleeding maybe has stopped. Has the president managed to re-seize the initiative in terms of discussing Iraq policy at this point?
I'm not sure I would say that he has the initiative at this point, partly because so much of the rationale we heard today sounded like 2003. And I think what the American people want to hear now is something that's about late 2005 and early 2006. They want to know where we're going, how we're going forward, what will be the conditions. Thought the strongest points the president made today, the best that he had to say, was the 4 major initiatives: transfer of sovereignty, elections in January, then the Constitution that got ratified in October, and now these elections coming tomorrow. I think all those things resonate well with Americans. I think they resonate well with Iraqis. That was the best thing he could put forward. That was his best argument against Murtha. But it doesn't answer the question of when do our troops come home.
Thanks to you all. Here with me in Studio 3A, NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving and NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins. George Packer, the author of Assassin's Gate, joined us from our bureau in New York. Adi Dawisha, who's a professor of political science, joined us from his office near Miami University. This is NPR News.
And you've been listening to Live.